Ted O'Brien, and this is Boston University's World of Ideas. 10 years ago, Operation Desert Storm was launched to push back the takeover of the Persian Gulf state of Kuwait by Iraq. The effort surprised and amazed the world. In a 100-hour whirlwind, the campaign destroyed large numbers of the Iraqi army and dictated a truce that continues to this day. At the time, it seemed that the goals of the coalition that opposed Iraq, which included virtually all the Western powers and most of Iraq's neighboring Arab states, had been fully met. Kuwait was liberated. Iraqi leader Saddam Hussein's war-making power was severely reduced, and the terms of the truce required the Iraqis to permit continuing inspections by United Nations experts for weapons of mass destruction. In addition, shipments of weapons and military equipment to Iraq were embargoed, and money from the sale of Iraqi oil was limited to purchasing food and medicine. The Iraqi Air Force subsequently was restricted as well, its operations denied access to certain no-fly zones that have since been enforced by U.S. and British Air Forces. Today, 10 years later, Saddam Hussein continues to be a thorn in the side of American foreign policy and a less than benevolent steward of the Iraqi people. Earlier this week, Boston University, together with Bar-Ilan University, held a symposium to reassess the Gulf War. The keynote speaker was retired Air Force Lieutenant General Brent Scowcroft, National Security Advisor to the first Bush administration from 1989 to 1993. Tonight, we will hear General Scowcroft's address and then talk with some Gulf War veterans about their personal experience. Here now is General Scowcroft.
The best thing I could do is just sort of walk through what we did, why we did it, what we thought we were doing, touching on the points that are, to me, the most interesting and relevant. I am not an impartial observer, but I will come as close to dispassion as I can. The first U.S. strategy for maintaining peace and security in the Gulf was to support the Shah of Iran as the vicar of stability in the area. And when the Shah left, we changed that policy to one of a balance of power in the Gulf to preserve stability at the least possible expense to the United States in terms of keeping forces there. Now, the balance of power, of course, between the two largest powers there, Iran and Iraq. And during the Iran-Iraq War, U.S. policy was designed just that, to try to preserve a balance. We didn't want either side to win, and we gave differential help to Iraq during that war, as, with the exception of the small perturbation of the Iran-Contra issue, we supported Iraq slightly because they were strategically the weaker of the two, according to our assessment. Well, after the end of that war, we continued an effort to see whether or not Saddam Hussein could be turned into a relatively reasonable member of the international community. And so we continued the policy, which had been developed during the Iran-Iraq War, of trying to cooperate with Saddam. And that worked fairly well until, I would say, somewhere in the very early part, late 1989 or 90, when at least it appeared to me that Saddam had made a decision and made an abrupt change in policy to attack both the United States and Israel, and to start airing his grievances against Kuwait. He became more and more vocal, more and more extreme, and the question came, should we change our policy, which was to try to get along with him. We were urged at that time not to by our Arab friends on the grounds that he was just feeling his oats. He changed. He didn't have anything that serious in mind, and that we should not do anything to provoke him. And so basically we didn't. Up right to the eve of the war, when our ambassador to Iraq was asked to meet with Saddam one-on-one, and she literally went there all by herself. She was an Arabic speaker. And following that interview, Saddam began to back away just a little bit. The president decided to send him a letter, which had started out as a first draft with a fairly strong warning and was tempered down, again on the advice of our friends in the Arab world, to encourage him to this new course that perhaps he was taking. Of course, it didn't work, and he invaded Kuwait. Now, were we wrong? That's the first point. Were we wrong? What should we have confronted him early on? In the light of history, which is the way we're looking at this conflict now, I would say no, that there was very little we could do in the way of signaling that would have made a difference with Saddam. And our tactics did make a big difference with the Arab world, because when the conflict actually came, there was no doubt who caused it. Had we confronted Saddam earlier, there would have been charges, well, you provoked him into it, he really didn't have to, you challenged his manhood, and so on. So we went into the conflict, or the conflict began, with the United States in a favorable position. Still, the Arabs at the outset said, this is an Arab problem, you stay out of it, United States, let us deal with it. That was a line which was abandoned after Saddam Hussein, or after Iraq, behaved so badly at the Arab summit in Cairo, but was continued, of course, by King Hussein throughout the war. So then we're faced with the conflict. At the outset, we did several things. As a matter of fact, the very evening of the conflict, we immediately froze the assets of not only Iraq, but Kuwait, because one of our fears was that whatever he did, whether he occupied Kuwait fully or not, he claimed that Kuwait was a province, and he set up a puppet government, and they could have stripped all the assets of Kuwait away. So we stopped that. We immediately went to the United Nations and got the Kuwaitis to ask for an urgent meeting of the Security Council, and we also consulted with our NATO allies. First NSC meeting was the next morning, and it was a curious meeting. It was an assessment meeting. It was not a decision meeting. What had happened, what were people saying about what had happened, what were positions of other people, where were our forces arrayed, what could we do about it. But there was a kind of a fait accompli atmosphere. Kuwait was at that time not particularly popular in the United States, and halfway around the world, very difficult place to get forces in any size. And so the discussion turned, well, how do we accommodate to this new change? What do we have to do? President Bush found that unacceptable. Right after the meeting, he and I debated about what to do to turn around this attitude. The next was to start out by laying out the stakes for the United States and the intolerability of Saddam not only being in a position now to perhaps dominate the Gulf, but also to have a key position in OPEC with a possible ability to dominate oil prices. The first decision that we made was that we had to send troops to Saudi Arabia. We had no idea what Saddam's goals were at that time, whether it was Kuwait or whether he would continue marching down the Gulf through Saudi Arabia to the Saudi oil fields. We approached the Saudi government and said that we were prepared to send troops. And surprisingly enough, we met a very we met a very cool response. And the response was, why should we trust you, basically? And they cited a couple of cases in the past where we had promised things, and then when the going got tough, we had turned around and bailed out. And the Saudis said, we can't afford to have that happen to us. Anyway, there were a couple of days there of back and forth before the president was able to persuade King Fahd that we meant what we said and we'd stay with him. We set up militarily at that point a three-pronged approach to the military. The first was to get some forces in on the border of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait immediately, as fast as we could, so that at a minimum, if Saddam went into Saudi Arabia, he would have to march over U.S. troops. Step two was to deploy enough troops to be able to defend Saudi Arabia against a determined effort by Iraq, and the JCS set that at about 200,000. And the third one was to keep our military options open for whatever we might want to do. That same weekend, a dramatic step occurred, and that is that the Soviet Union stood up beside us and condemned the invasion. The first time since the Cold War that the two big nuclear powers had stood on the same side of a local conflict. And credit for that, I believe, goes almost entirely to the foreign minister, Shevardnadze. Gorbachev would not make a decision on it. There was a split inside the Politburo, and Shevardnadze took it upon himself to stand up and condemn it. The grand strategy, which we developed, was to isolate Iraq, to blockade oil, close down all the pipelines, and blockade ocean shipment, to build a coalition beginning with Egypt and Morocco, who had offered to send troops, along with a number of NATO, to build a coalition, not to do it ourselves, build a coalition, military coalition, to participate in whatever would happen, and to ask those who couldn't participate, and primarily we had in mind Germany and Japan, whose constitutions prevented them contributing military forces, to contribute to cash instead, and to set about building a network of UN resolutions which would give sanction to what we were doing and bless it in the name of the world community. We also decided that we ought to behave in this crisis, the first post-Cold War crisis, in a way that could set a pattern for dealing with aggression thereafter. In other words, to establish the way we handled it to be a model for dealing with such crises in the future. And that did affect, in several cases, the way we acted. And last, Saddam early on tried hard to link what he had done in Kuwait with the peace process between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and to convene, for example, a Middle East conference which would deal with both of them. That, in other words, to try to say that the UN had failed on the peace process, Resolution 242, 338, and so on, were not enforced, but here you want to enforce them against Kuwait. We successfully resisted any kind of linkage there, but we did informally and quietly agree that when this was over, we would be prepared to put our weight behind a renewal of the peace process. Handling the Soviets turned out to be delicate. We did not want the UN to run the war. And the UN Military Committee to be the governing body. Instead, we wanted the coalition sanctioned to do the military aspect. And we also didn't want Soviet troops to participate in the coalition. We still, you know, the Cold War was just barely over. This was the first time we'd gotten together. And we were afraid if we got Soviet troops in the Middle East, we might have a great deal of trouble getting back out again. So we offered to have them join the naval forces in the Gulf who were participating in the blockade. Congress, fortunately, was on summer recess when the crisis started. We called the leaders by phone and so on, and had a briefing session at the end of August for those who had come back. The Congress was very supportive in the beginning in terms of the forces we were sending to defend Saudi Arabia. Implementing this grand strategy took us into October when the situation changed dramatically. One of the first questions that we had that we wrestled with was, if we were to use force to get the Iraqis out of Kuwait, did we have to have a provocation to which we would respond, or could we simply attack? And that was a complicated question, and it took us some time to resolve how we would do it. But in the early days, September and October, the issue of provocation and how do you get a provocation was a really serious one. And a part of that, resolving that, we decided to send Jim Baker around to, especially to the members of the Security Council and to other key UN states, to test the water on the passing of a resolution which would authorize the coalition to use whatever means necessary to remove Iraqi troops from Kuwait. At that same time, in at the end of October, we had completed the buildup of forces sufficient to defend Saudi Arabia, about 200,000. And the question was, do we continue the buildup or not? While the president, in the first 3 days, had decided that Iraqi troops had to be removed from Kuwait, he had not decided exactly how that had to be done. If we stopped the deployment at the 200,000 level and then decided that we needed forces enough to go on the offensive, it would throw the military planning into a total mess. So in order to keep our options open, we continued the deployment. This was October 31st, that decision was made. There were congressional elections the following week, I think on the 6th or 7th of November, and the political types said, don't announce this. Don't do consultations on the Hill till after the election. Be a disaster. Well, what happened, obviously, was that it leaked, and the Congress was furious. And they said, basically, you've changed the whole character of war, of the conflict, from a defensive one to try to protect our ally Saudi Arabia into perhaps an offensive war and without congressional approbation. The Congress turned pretty sharply against us. And the argument became, let sanctions work. Don't go to military force. Keep the blockade on and let sanctions work. We weren't sure that time was on our side. Ramadan started in March. Bad weather started in February and March. And if we waited past that window, after Ramadan was over, the weather was very, very hot. So we had a very narrow window, and letting sanctions work was not a very palliative issue. There was a very basic constitutional issue which was debated, and that is, what authority did the president have, and what authority does the Congress have? And this is one of those cases where the Constitution neatly divides responsibility. Only the Congress can declare war, and the Congress, of course, appropriates money for the military forces. But the president is commander in chief. There was also the issue of the War Powers Act and what role that ought to play. No president, since it had been passed, had acknowledged its validity. And in this case, it did not play much of a role. But the constitutional issue was one that the president had every time he had a congressional meeting. In the meantime, Jim Baker's out beating the bushes here to get the mood of the members of the Security Council. And it turned out to be surprisingly positive. And that helped us decide both on whether or not we needed provocation, and also whether to go to the Congress first, or whether to go to the Congress at all, or whether to use the UN. And we decided to go to the UN first. So at the end of November, we successfully got a resolution authorizing all necessary means. That meant, of course, we had to go to the Congress. There is no doubt in my mind that even if the Congress had said no, the president would have used force, but it would have been a mess constitutionally. But having gotten permission of the UN, he could not go to the Congress. It was a very, very tough fight. We asked the Congress not to authorize the use of force because we were convinced the president had that right as commander-in-chief to use force. We asked him to support the UN resolution. Well, the House passed one and the Senate passed another. Passed the Senate 52-47, the closest vote to go to war that this country has ever had. Well, there were several complicating factors between that and the actual beginning of the conflict. The coalition got shakier and shakier with the French. Mitterrand suggesting it would be good if he went to Iraq to try to resolve it. Chancellor Kohl was a problem. The UN Secretary General went. Anyway, on January 16th, we began the air war, followed by, after about a month, by the ground war. There was one prelude to the ground war, and that was a battle at the little town of Kafchi in Saudi Arabia, which turned out to be a forecast of the way the war went, but I think Saddam Hussein thought that he would be able to send a lot of body bags home and we might back out. The war went generally according to plan, with one large exception, and that is that the basic strategy had been for the Marines to attack frontally against the Iraqi strength and bring the Republican Guard, which was on the border of Kuwait and Iraq, down to reinforce them, at which time the left hook would surround the Republican Guard. The Marines moved so rapidly and successfully and were not held back that the Republican Guard never came down. We didn't know that in Washington. So that the left hook around the back did not encircle a lot of the Republican Guard. Otherwise, it went up pretty much according to schedule. Did we stop too soon? I think we could easily have gone another 24 hours and have devastated more of the Republican Guard than we did, which was one of our objectives. It would have made a tactical, not a strategic difference. Should we have gone to Baghdad and, as everybody's fond of saying now, finished the job? We did not consider that at the time, nor looking back on it from 10 years later, would I do it now. First of all, we were trying to set a pattern for behavior. We had the mandate of the United Nations to kick the Iraqis out of Kuwait. We did not have the mandate to march to Baghdad to overthrow Saddam Hussein. Secondly, one of the things we thought we learned by studying the Korean War was the dangers of changing your strategy when you're doing well. Thirdly, the coalition would have fractured immediately. The Arab forces were with us in throwing the Iraqis out of Kuwait. They were not with us and would not have been with us in marching into a fellow Arab state. Indeed, as it was, they did not cross the border into Iraq. They stopped at the border. So I'm comfortable with that. What we did not do is anticipate the way the war actually ended. We were pretty confident that Saddam would suffer a defeat so devastating, which he did, that his military would rise against him and overthrow him. They did not. Whether they would under different circumstances, it's hard to say. But one of the things that happened right at the end was an uprising, both of the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south. And it is not impossible that the military saw the nation fracturing and thought that Saddam was the lesser of the evils. In any case, it didn't come out that way, the way we thought. The arrangements at Safwan were okay, except for the helicopter, letting Saddam fly helicopters. The sanctions that were put in for a specific purpose, and that was to ensure that Saddam was disarmed in the sense of weapons of mass destruction, and that until the UNSCOM could declare that he had been cleansed of all such weapons and the ability to make them, the sanctions would stay on. They were not put on to overthrow Saddam Hussein, which became one of our purposes later on. The no-fly zones were added later in order to protect the Kurds and the Shiites from aerial assault by the Iraqi forces. They were not specifically sanctioned by the UN.
General Brent Scowcroft speaking earlier this week on the Gulf War as history. But what is history for us is something far more to the men and women who fought the making of that history, from the ships in the Persian Gulf, the air bases in Saudi Arabia, and in the desert sands of Kuwait and Iraq. With me in the studio are two veterans of the conflict to give us their experience of the war we watched on television. From the United States Navy, Lieutenant Commander Rick Miller. Commander, nice to have you with us.
Thank you, Ted. Pleasure to be here.
And from the United States Army Reserve, retired Major John Welch. John, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Ted.
Where did you serve? Rick, maybe you could start.
I was on a Aegis guided missile cruiser, the USS Leyte Gulf, and served during the period of hostilities in the Arabian Gulf area with the aircraft carrier forces that were operating in the Gulf. And then following the conflict, we stayed in the Gulf in the Red Sea area for several months, performing sanction enforcement in the area.
And what operations were you involved in? Were there anything specific, or was it...
Well, the ship conducted a multitude of tasks during the conflict, including Tomahawk strike missions into Iraq. We also conducted a large portion of the air defense network in the northern Arabian Gulf area and for the four aircraft carriers that were operating in the Gulf and conducting air ops and strikes into Iraq. And then, again, following the hostility phase, we were conducting sanction enforcement in the northern Arabian Gulf and then also over in the Red Sea.
John Welch, you commanded a data processing unit, I understand.
Yes, sir. That was a unit consisting of three 35-foot trailers contained in which there was an IBM mainframe computer. The computer was responsible for the entire logistical databases for the Gulf War at the theater level, which is the highest level, the command level. We were a little bit less glamorous than the fact that we weren't one of the shooters, but we're the guys who made sure that the beans and the bullets were there, sir.
But you were also one of the shot at. There was no rear area in this war.
The reports that I've had following the war, we had something like 18 Scud missiles come into our area, including the one that we were about a mile and a half away from the one that struck what was referred to as a barracks, but in reality was the warehouse part of a children's toy store.
Which killed, I think, 28 American service people who were busy inside that warehouse.
Yes, sir, and actually that's 28 at the time, and there were several others who died of their injuries later on, including one NCO who came from New Hampshire.
We somehow, through all of that, had a sense that the war lasted 4 days, and that was that. How long were you actually over there, and what did you do before the war started, Rick?
We deployed, actually, on my ship in late December, and we raced with the last carrier at high speed across the Atlantic through the Mediterranean, transited the Suez Canal to basically bring that carrier into the Gulf as hostilities opened in mid-January. And then we stayed and didn't return home until almost the beginning of July.
Hmm. How about you, John?
Well, we were actually called to active duty in September of 1990. We spent a very brief period at Fort Devens going through an abbreviated training period and making sure that all the medical records and that sort of thing were up to date. And then we were flown out of Westover, and we got into Tahran on the 6th of October 1990, and we didn't return until the end of June 1991.
Mm.
We were actually, I was told, the longest-serving reserve component unit in the operation.
Were you surprised at the call-up?
When the invasion happened on the first weekend in August 1990, we were having a weekend drill. And I told my troops at that time that we had as much chance of being called up as I did having won in the lottery. So the members of the unit got together and bought me a one-year lottery ticket.
That's their way of saying, thanks, Major.
And no, I didn't win.
Well, we know, I should mention at this point that you, Rick, are a professional serving officer in the United States Navy. You were commissioned in June of 1989, graduate of Annapolis. So this was a part of, in a sense, the normal course of your duties. But, John, what were you doing before your reserve unit was called up?
I was a software consultant working at a little small company in Cambridge called Polaroid. And I got a phone call coming home from one night from work, and they said, this is the call. And I said, where and when? And they said, we don't know yet. And I said, I'd appreciate it if you knew where and when by the time I got there.
Right.
So I had to pack my bags, and I went in first, and then the rest of the unit came in as we got more information.
Take us back to either January 17th and or February 24th. Where were you? What happened? And what was it like in the moments before the offensive began? Rick, you're aboard a guided missile cruiser, and the orders are coming down.
We were coming up through the Gulf of Oman, getting ready to enter the Straits of Hormuz. And, you know, at that point prior to the war, you know, before it started, obviously people had a different perception afterwards. But, you know, the Iraqi military was touted to be, I think, the fourth largest in the world. The predictions for casualties were very high. So there was a lot of tension and you know, sort of anxious anticipation of what was going to happen. We were listening to the radio circuits. We knew that the strike packages were getting ready to launch. We knew, we had seen, because we were also a Tomahawk shooter, that the ships that were firing the initial salvos of Tomahawks were had their missiles spun up and ready to go. And, of course, not knowing how the Iranians were going to play at the time and having to come through the Straits of Hormuz, there was some, you know, anxious moments as we were ready to sprint through there in the darkness of night and try and make it to our assigned position in the Gulf.
Once you were there, then you undertook fire missions, correct?
That's correct. We did a combination of we moved back and forth between our launch position for Tomahawk missions and then also escorting, again, the four carriers and providing air defense for them and also helping deconflict and sort out the hundreds of aircraft that were flying in the area to make sure that we didn't have any engagement against any of our friendly aircraft and protect the ships that were out there.
Did you come into contact with any Iraqis in the course of the air defense?
We didn't come into contact directly in the carrier operating area. Some of our other ships farther up north were controlling aircraft that were in conflict with the Iraqis. Certainly the aircraft we were dealing with from the carriers were involved in air-to-air engagements with some of the Iraqi forces and also against some of the Iraqi patrol craft and their naval ships up in the northern Gulf area.
John, somehow we don't think of data processors as soldiers. What was the feeling in your unit at the time the war began?
The real concern, the major concern that most of the troops were feeling is one was the uncertainty of it all. I had one young NCO, a female, who was, let's just say, not performing very well while we were waiting. But when the ground war actually started, it's like she almost came to life. And she was one of the people that I really relied on. I thought about it afterwards, and I thought her real problem was the fact that what she had problems with was the waiting, which is always the biggest thing in any conflict is the waiting. You just sit and it's going to happen, it's going to happen, but you don't know when. The other concern that they had is there was much to be done about the fact that he would have no hesitation in employing chemical weapons, and the Scud missiles that he was aiming at us were chemical capable. Mm-hmm. In fact, our procedure was on any attack warning, if we had radar that there was inbound Scud missiles, that everybody went into full chemical protective gear. And that's the gloves, the boots, the coats, everything. We had test devices that we did for it, and we had an awful lot of training in that regard.
February 24th began the ground war. Did that affect your operations in any way?
Just on the speed of it, just the amount of work that we were doing. And, of course, the incident at the barracks was probably the largest single thing. I happen to have known personally several people who were living in what they call the barracks. In fact, one of them, as I had alluded to earlier, was an NCO from New Hampshire who was severely wounded and later on died from his wounds. And the one I knew the best was a Captain Aziz who works for the Veterans Administration here in Boston. So it was personal with us.
It was personal with you, too. You served in Vietnam in a helicopter unit and then went into the reserves. Is it safe for me to expect that in the kind of work you were doing in the reserves, you never expected to be called again?
No, but that's what we were there for. And to be honest, there was a great deal of satisfaction knowing all the nights, all the weekends, all the 2 weeks in the summer that, you know what the standard line for what a reserve component does. The fact that after all that time, and all those years, that when the call came, we actually stepped up and performed. And the thing I'm most proud of is the fact that my unit was awarded a citation called the Meritorious Unit Citation, which is the highest award for a non-combat unit can be awarded for their performance in a combat zone. So I'm very proud of what they did over there.
That's an indication that the performance of the unit was such that each individual in it deserved decoration, so they decorated the unit as a whole.
Yes, sir.
That is a great compliment. Can you compare the two experiences for us, Vietnam and Operation Desert Storm?
During Vietnam, sir, to be quite honest, I was young and stupid. It was in a Latin phrase, a mirabile spectato, which means it was a great wonderment to me. You know, everything was happening. Things would occur. As in every conflict, there's a 99% waiting and then a short brief period of tremendous activity and then waiting all over again. In Vietnam, you didn't know who your friends were as much as you did in the Persian Gulf War. And the second and probably most important thing is during the Persian Gulf War, you knew exactly what you were there for, and you knew how it was going to be measured that it would be accomplished. Vietnam was more of a thing that everybody just went and did their time, and then they came home again, and then somebody else went over. You know, it was like a continuum with no end, at least at the time I was going there. But we had a direct mission for the Gulf War. And when we did A, B, C, and D, stopped the war, we're finished, we won, time to go home.
Rick, Clausewitz writes about the fog of war, all the uncertainty. Is that what you experienced?
Certainly think there's an element of that. That the fact it was funny, John mentioned the chemical warnings. It reminded me of one evening we were in the Gulf. Our radar system was tracking Scud missiles going down into Saudi Arabia. We certainly had the intelligence indications that he may put chemical or biological weapons, warheads, on those missiles. And I happened to be standing watch up on the bridge as the conning officer driving the ship that night. And one of our chemical detection systems had a malfunction, but it indicated and went off as if we had entered a chemical cloud. Of course, not knowing it was a malfunction at the time, we treated it as a real chemical attack and set battle stations, general quarters on the ship. And everybody got dressed into their chemical suits, and we went about, you know, sealing up the ship, making it airtight, started our routine of going through and inspecting the inside of the ship first to find out if we really had been contaminated. My duties at the time, I was responsible for what we call a repair locker. It's one of the organizations that fights fires, controls flooding, damage on the ship. And I remember afterwards, you know, I had been standing next to the sensor when it went off, and I reached into my pouch and took out my automatic injectors of the agent to counter, you know, chemicals if you get it into your body. And I handed it to the chief petty officer that was my assistant, because I knew that if anybody was affected, it was going to be myself and two or three others that had been standing near that sensor when it went off. And, you know, was going through my mind thinking of all the different symptoms of, you know, what happens to you and what do you sense as you realize you've been affected by an agent. And I handed the needles to the chief, and I said, "Hey, if I start twitching and fall over, please stick me in the leg with this." And you know, but the tremendous professionalism, you know, I had two sailors that we had completed the survey inside the ship, realized we were okay inside, but it was time to send them out and go see if we really had a, you know, chemical agent on the outside of the ship. And without hesitation, you know, they went right off, went through the proper doors and hatches to get outside and not affect the rest of the ship, did the survey. You know, we later found out that it was a false alarm and we didn't have agent, but you know, looking back on it afterwards, you know, we could kind of laugh about it after the fact. But at the time, I mean, it was a very, you know, terrifying realization that, you know, you might have been affected by a chemical or a biological agent. And, you know, I really thought about these two young sailors that went out there without hesitation. You know, they weren't much younger than I was at the time. And their training and their professionalism, they didn't even hesitate. They were there to take care of their shipmates, take care of their ship, and do their job. And that's what they went and did. And, you know, it was a great feeling, like John said afterwards, that, you know, the ship, we trained well. We trained for months before we went over there. And we did our job. We did it well. And we came home, brought everybody back.
That concern about the atmosphere was a major change from your time in Vietnam, John, when Agent Orange was around and in use and people weren't concerned about what they were breathing. And I noticed from some of the photographs that you're in your fatigues next to burning wells and so forth. There was a lot of stuff put into the air everywhere on that battlefield and in the surrounding area. Did you feel any effects yourself from it?
There are some issues I'm personally dealing with the Veterans Administration on. There are some effects from it. I've also been involved in a 10-year-long study through also the Veterans Administration to see what our long-term effects are. And one of the things that I found most disturbing is a significant portion of my particular command had some medical problems coming back from the Gulf. A couple of them had really bad blood problems and several other things that we haven't figured out the exact causes of yet. But it was certainly a lot higher than anything that we were exposed to in Vietnam. Although, to be quite honest, I did get exposed to Agent Orange at one point. Yeah, the entire environment, the place in which we were living and how we were living was of much more concern to us in the Gulf War. As a matter of fact, I'll show it to you later. I brought in you a photograph. I have a photograph of a highway in Saudi Arabia. You can see the tarmac, you can see the white sand, and the entire sky is black from ground level to the as high as you can go. That was taken at 12 o'clock noon, 175 miles south of Kuwait City. And the cloud was totally black when you get down there. So, yeah, what was in the air was of a great concern to us.
How do you think the country sees the war? This is one for both of you. One historian writing in the March American Heritage magazine spoke of it as a war against history, that it hardly registers on the national consciousness. Has that been your experience, Rick?
I'm not sure if the Gulf War itself doesn't register. I certainly appreciated and experienced a tremendous amount of public, I think, support for our efforts over there, coming from, you know, the thousands of letters that we received on the ship that were just written to any soldier, any sailor that were sent to the Gulf, to my neighbors coming up to me when I returned home that were, you know, just coming up and thanking me for my service and what I've gone and did in the Gulf. So I'm not sure that the Gulf War itself is necessarily forgotten, but I think what may be forgotten or is paid less attention to in the last 10 years since then, I have deployed and thousands of others have deployed to numerous places around the world and, you know, not anywhere near the level of, I think, support or interest from the American public at large in the fact that our military forces are out there day to day and in many cases out there in combat conditions, taking fire and exchanging fire with others. And I guess I would, you know, as a serviceman today, I would like to at least see a level of interest in what goes on in our foreign policy and our defense policy, that the American people are at least aware of it and take an interest in it, that we do have troops out there and that they do need the support to continue doing the job that they're doing.
And John, how do you see the country looking back at the Gulf War?
Pretty much the same, but in a slightly different. Coming back from the Gulf War was a tremendously emotional experience for me. I actually couldn't go to any of the parades. I couldn't make myself go to them. When I came back, the treatment that I got when I came back from Vietnam, I literally did get spit on, by the way, when I came back, contrasted with the way that we were received when we came back from the Gulf War, I found it too embarrassing to actually to attend. In the long run, I really agree with Rick in the fact that the people who are out on the line right now, who are in some very thankless places, in some very quiet places that doesn't quite get the attention of the media, are putting their lives on the line just as much as my people were in the Gulf War. And it's those who we really should look to because they're, to be honest, our successes in a continuum of this stuff. So, yeah, the coming back from the Gulf was a big highlight. Everybody was happy about it. I think probably the biggest thing they were happy about was the fact that on the American side there was very little loss of life, although I did lose a couple of friends over there. The amount compared to what we expected was very, very slight, so there was relief there in that. But the people now are the people who really need our support.
The Allied troops killed were, for U.S. casualties, there were 383 killed, 458 wounded, and 510 Allied casualties in all. But if you extrapolate that over the 10-year period of the Vietnam War, that would add up to about 43,000 casualties, something more than Korea, although less than Vietnam. What does this say about quick in, massive force, and quick out?
Well, I think there's a certain advantage in being able to fight that way if you can. You know, you go in with overwhelming force. We have an incredibly well-trained professional force. I know in the news of late there's been a lot of concern about military readiness and whatnot, and that is a concern. And I think that goes back again to the point that, you know, I would really appreciate the American people to be interested and to be knowledgeable about what's going on and to voice their opinion that, you know, if we do maintain forces and we do maintain troops in these types of activities, then they require the support they need so that when they do have to fight, that you have a success like Desert Storm in the military sense and not end up with something that the American people would not be happy with the result.
And finally, we just have a few seconds left, but I'd like each of you, if you would, to think of an 18, 19, 20-year-old out there who's a civilian kid. What would you have to say to him about the military, about the possibilities that exist, both pro and con?
Well, actually, I have a nephew right now who's a senior in the Air Force ROTC program over at Boston University. And I served for 26 years. My brother is still serving. The generation before me served. My grandfather was awarded a battlefield commission at Chateau Thierry. There can be no more honor than to serve your country when called. There is no more noble thing you can do to take up arms to defend the freedom of your neighbors. There is an awful lot of downside to it. There's an awful lot of sacrifices made, very high percentage of divorce within the military, constant moving, constant sacrifice. But the rewards in the end are worth it.
I would echo what John said. I mean, there is a lot of personal sacrifice to serve. But I think first and foremost is when you serve in the military, you serve your country, you make a difference, and you lead a life that matters. And ultimately, when you look back on your life, I think you want to look back and think you did something that made a difference and that matters.
I want to thank you both. You've been listening to a Boston University World of Ideas conversation and talk on the Persian Gulf War 10 years later. Our guests have been Army Major John Welch and Navy Lieutenant Commander Rick Miller. Giving the talk was former National Security Advisor General Brent Scowcroft. Join us next week for a roundtable discussion with journalists from the Balkans who've been participating in a 2-month-long training program through Boston University. For a cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes are $15, including shipping and handling. And visit our website at wbur.org and wrni.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cozzelli. Tonight's program was produced by Glenn Alexander, Bob Zalisk, and Doug Sugarth. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.
This is WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by The MathWorks, makers of MathLab and Simulink, technical computing